Okay, as people take their seats, it gives me great pleasure to introduce this next section of our program, which, as you see from the agenda, very clearly heralded as visions of response to the changing landscape. We were fully aware that this morning there would be a wide range of ideas, very, very dense in many ways in terms of the material that we were covering, but felt that all of those issues connected in some way and that it was useful to cover them in our opening session. As I mentioned just before lunch, both this afternoon and then all of tomorrow is really about digesting that material and doing rather more than digesting it, reconstructing it in terms of visions and agendas. And this session is intended as a transition in that way of activity. I mentioned earlier on that you see from the groups that we'll be going into later, we've used this construct of a constituency. And we don't want to take that too literally. People on the stage are not delegates of a particular union or professional association. But it does acknowledge something that came out of the planning meeting very importantly, which is that in terms of understanding global public health leadership or public health leadership in global health, we understand there's a wide variety of institutions and groups involved in that. And quite explicitly, we feel through this session that each of the constituencies represented has a contributory role in formulating what that leadership should be, what the field should look like, what its priorities should be. And so it's a great delight to have our six participants, Bernice Dan from the Ministry of Health in Liberia, Ayman El-Mohandas from the University of Nebraska School of Public Health, Miguel Angles Gonzalez Block from the National Institute of Public Health in Mexico, Florence Bangana from Makerere University School of Public Health, Uganda, Prakash Mani Sharma from ProPublic Nepal, and Derek Yak from PepsiCo USA. And as you see from the program, each of them very much speaking as individuals, but currently in their roles, particularly reflecting on one of the constituencies or one of the contributors to our thinking through this field. This session is very much meant to be interactive. We're trying to put people at their ease, sitting them comfortably so we can have reflective thoughts. And we have microphones to share around here. And if the opportunity arises, we'll open this out for broader discussion towards the end of the session. Bernice, I want to come to you first and very much aware of your role within a Ministry of Health and in Liberia. And I wanted to ask you, in terms of being a representative of government, seeing the issues this morning through that lens, really what you made of the challenges and the opportunities of this changing landscape. What were the issues that we were talking about that, from your perspective, where you're currently working, were the biggest drivers, the things that were a hook for you? If you just take the microphone and then we'll be able to hear you. Thanks, Bernice.
I think it's just like that.
Okay, thank you. Well, I think one thing I learned from this morning is that our individual countries form a part of a global health network. And if our individual countries form a part of a global health network, then I would like to bring it down to taking the global network like a person. If you take a human being, for example, you will say that the head cannot stand alone. It is dependent on the leg or the hand, and so you need every part of the body to be a whole. Now, if we take that scenario and looking at the different things that drive the changing landscape for health globally, I think personally, I think if you look at the individual things, there were things that contributed to nations changing, especially if you look at the population changes, the population dynamics, and every country at a different level at a specific point in time. I believe if in those days, if we were thinking as one, and we were planning as one, maybe we would have planned a global health policy, which is one, a global health strategic plan, which will be one, and the interventions will be one. And if that had happened that way during those initial days, I believe countries would have been at the same level at this particular point in time. If you take, for instance, the developed countries now, with the invention of antibiotics, they were able to get rid of some of the diseases that we are still battling with today. If in those days all the obstacles were moved and those antibiotics reached the farthest they could reach, I believe today people at my age and working maybe in the same position will be addressing similar issues and not different issues. So I believe that if we can work together, set a vision for now that looks into the future, that will actually address the health and wealth inequities among countries and among nations, we'll be able to make some headways.
Bernice, can I just ask you very specifically, in the case of Liberia, emerging from a period of conflict, many challenges, and there was this word of sovereignty and shared sovereignty. From working within the Ministry of Health and planning for recovery within the nation, what did you make of that discussion in terms of where power and authority lies within Liberia, within the ministry, and where else it lies, and how you understand that sharing?
Well, I think every nation wants to be proud of itself, and we'll talk about sovereignty. But if you look at the way health issues are addressed, and if you take Liberia for example, even though we are a nation, we have a budget, we have a challenge, we have priorities, competing priorities, and our national budget cannot support health adequately. And so we rely on other people for help globally. Now, when it comes to that, how are the decisions made? Though we'll say it is our country, we have a national health policy, we have a national health plan, resources should be aligned to our national health plan, it is not entirely true in a sense that every resource that comes in is aligned very closely to our policies. Sometimes we don't even have the decisions to make because the decisions are made where the money is coming from. Take, for instance, if you take the U.S. and have funds that are supposed to support malaria, it is malaria. So if my priority at a particular given point in time is diarrhea, that funding will support malaria and it will not support diarrhea. So if from the beginning we had a common plan and the resources are supporting the plan generally, it might be much easier to make decisions to address issues within the plan.
Okay, thank you, Bernice. We'll come back to you later. Yes, if you pass the microphone to Ayman. I want to come, Ayman, to you and ask the same broad question in terms of the broad panoply of issues, very broad range of issues that were addressed this morning. As you sit as a newish dean of a school of public health and the sense of responsibility and the sense of vision for what schools of public health can contribute, which were the elements of that agenda that you felt particular excitement about, either in terms of the challenges there or the opportunities they provided?
Well, to be honest with you, although in my role as a dean, I'm just a year old, but I've been an educator in public health for several decades. And the thing that intrigued me was the first call to action by Linda is to act differently, to see differently, and to think differently. And I immediately tried to apply that to the paradigm of developing the new workforce in public health globally and how we educate our students to become leaders in public health. And we really do need a paradigm shift there. We need to act differently, see differently, and think differently. I agree with you, Linda. The question is exactly how. It's very, very challenging. I am on one of the committees. I chair one of the committees for the Association of Schools of Public Health that are engaged in thinking about global health education. And I must admit, the paradigm as it stands is complex. We're looking for people to admit into schools in the Northern Hemisphere with some cross-cultural experience so that they have, you know, some of the basic skills that we can invest upon in trying to shift the way they think and act once they graduate and participate in the global health workforce today. But I think what we need to really start to think about is how are we going to scale up, as has been mentioned many times today, how are we going to scale up workforce development in the public health profession in the part of the world that is burdened with the largest public health challenges as they stand today. And we haven't started to think about that adequately. And it's enough to go to some of these countries and confront some of these problems head on to realize that there is no way that we can sustain an infusion of imports from other parts of the world to be able to solve these problems in their entirety. And as we progress, unless these countries, these communities, these nations are entirely independent of us, then we have failed our mission. And to be very honest with you, in many of the challenges that were mentioned today, in issues of inequity, in issues of efficacy, in the new public health order, I immediately see an important challenge that we have not talked about, which is how are we going to scale up the public health workforce in these countries. And as much as we are focused on clinicians, nurses, and physicians, we seem to be talking less about public health professionals. And although we say that the public health profession will play as an important, integral, central role in changing the health reality and the life reality in these communities, we don't seem to be focused enough on who is going to do it. Because the answer is not that we are going to do it for you or even with you. It is going to be eventually that you will do it for yourselves in the way that is best suited to your priorities and your environment, your communities, and your culture, and your needs. And we are here to support you. So we need that infrastructure, and it's very, very urgent.
So, Eamon, can I build on that and ask you, I think Julia mentioned that the global is not the opposite of local or domestic. In terms of the priorities of a school, do you agree with that sentiment? And how do you encompass a mission for a school that is global, reflecting both that reality within the US, but also having those linkages that you're hinting at in terms of a solidarity with others?
Surely. Well, you know, I am the Dean of the College of Public Health in the University of Nebraska, and one of the greatest surprises to me was when I arrived in Omaha was that the largest Sudanese immigrant population in the United States resides in Omaha. Now, who of you would have guessed that? I have worked with the university administration, with the medical center, and continue to work with the faculty and the students to emphasize a global vision. But no matter what, globality, either culturally, politically, socioeconomically, and in health, is a crystal that has a million facets. And to ignore the facet is to take away something from the reality of that crystal. We have to acknowledge the crystal. We have to acknowledge its globality. We have to acknowledge the multiplicity. But we have to acknowledge every facet. So it's not taking away from the uniqueness of the needs and the problem in every one of these facets by acknowledging that it is one crystal. Does that answer your question?
It does. Thank you. Vika, well, can I come to you? And again, the first initial question, but again, I think you, as a number of members of the panel, have worn different hats at different times. Now you wear a hat with a particular responsibility for leading a research institute. And I wondered, again, in terms of our understanding of the issues, reflect on this morning, where you saw the particular place of research to contribute to clarifying those issues, but also then solutions to them.
Thank you very much. Indeed, for the past, it's going to be 30 years now, we have been working with Julio Frank and other colleagues to put the concept of health systems and health systems research in the forefront and to make it a valuable set of research knowledge and the paradigms that can help in developing health systems in Mexico and internationally. And indeed, from that perspective, I face, first of all, a very clear ethical dilemma, in the sense that research is meant to be cold, objective, to give the facts, to be able to address the various components and come down, as indeed in one of our panelists put it, you know, to the very specific issues that can be accomplished and their indicators and so forth. And yet, we face conditions of exclusion, of conditions of disparities and that call for the researchers to be absolutely engaged with the issue. So global health does pose that dilemma in a big canvas, I would say, for research, how to be able to choose one's research themes, research questions, and methodologies with great care, but at the same time to make sure that we are directing them to where they are most needed. One of those issues has to be, it's very, very poignant right now, because after the insurance reform in this country and in Mexico, the universal insurance also instituted by Julio Frank in the past, it's going to be now about 10 years nearly, we see that about 8 million Mexicans residing in this country have been left without health insurance on either side. And indeed, they are the last substantial group of people on this side of the border not to have health insurance. So as a researcher, what I have done for the past 6 or 7 years is to try to address ways of establishing insurance schemes, financial protection schemes, that will enable this group of people not to be left out in the gap. And even though we have done a substantial analysis of feasibility, costing, looking at institutional development, and identified the multi-level complexities of insurance solutions for this population, we still find that there is little interest, both on the side of the Mexican government and on the US side also, to address it frontally, in spite of the evidence that we have tried to place in front of them. Because indeed, according to the Mexican Constitution, there is a right to health for Mexicans or for all residents of the country. Those that are outside the country, they are often seen as to be voluntarily outside, which is, of course, not the case at all. They are economic exiles. So the country does have a responsibility, especially if we see that the country benefits to the tune of $23 billion per year from remittances coming to Mexico.
Miguel, can I just build on that in terms of the relationship that you see between research and advocacy on one part and asserting value and rights, and research and policy on the other? I think those are two dimensions you're wrestling with there, that researchers have a reputation for doing their research, publishing their papers, and not being committed to following through. Very much you're suggesting a different model. But how, in terms of advocacy and in terms of policy, do you see researchers making a contribution here?
I think researchers have to make sure that they can push their research through the right channels and be able to do it without in any way exposing their objectivity or their methodology to any kind of critique for that ethical stance. So we do need brokering elements here in the system, and global health has to provide very vocal advocates that they can take the research and also to inform researchers on the agenda, so that they can set for us as researchers a very clear set of questions that we can then address in an objective manner, but that we are not forced to play both roles of being the researcher and the advocate, because that places or can compromise the objectivity of our research.
And the lack of influence on policy that you were hinting at, is whose fault is that, or how could that be addressed? How do we ensure that research enables more powerfully a policy formulation?
Well, I think it's a question of health as a human right. That in the example of migrants here in the U.S., but of course migrants elsewhere. With my colleague of the United Arab Emirates, we were commenting that in his country, 80% of the residents are foreign-born, and they are only as guest workers in their country. So if we don't have a clear conception of rights, we then are exposing these populations to fragility, especially in their countries of origin, because most of them, including Mexicans here, will go back to their countries, but they will go back without savings, without contributions, without having directly participated in strengthening the health infrastructure. So unless we establish those mechanisms as a matter of human rights, then I don't think we will move forward very much. Just to finalize, I think it's critical not only to work on health systems as the how to strengthen them, but to do so always in a dialogue with disease control programs, so that we see that the disease control program is well supported by health systems, and that health systems are well supported by disease control programs, because that relationship is here to stay for a long time. Even in comprehensive health systems, we still have, in order to ensure impact, we need to look at problem by problem. And unless we recognize specific problems, how can they be supported by health systems through issues of packages, of costing, cost effectiveness, but also specifically of their technical organizational needs, then I don't think we will, I mean, we're by pushing the pendulum too much on the side of health systems, we may forget that disease control programs and prevention programs and so forth are where the rubber hits the road, so to speak.
That's a good bridge to a question to Florence. And particularly, I wanted to build upon your experience in the field of advocating for, but very much in terms of supporting development of mental health services in lower middle-income countries. And I wondered again in terms of the broad set of issues we looked at this morning, where in terms of that agenda, that in terms of driving forward programmatic delivery in terms of effective, impactful services, where you felt that fitted within those broader concerns?
Well, I actually had a number. I don't know whether it actually fitted, but for me, they're the things that seem to stick out in relation to maybe the issue of mental health. But one issue that kept coming up for me was the social determinants and the social inequalities. And the idea that we did speak about it quite a bit, but when it came to thinking about maybe the way forward, I think we kept going back to almost public health being in the medical domain and not so much involving the social work domain. And I think, although we do talk about interdependencies, I think we don't in practice actually practice that way. And so something else also that seemed to keep coming up for me was the idea that NCDs, I mean, we were talking a lot about silos, or this morning there was a lot of talk about silos of the different programs, and how I think we do agree that having a silo approach, it's easier to measure and actually achieve effectiveness through the silo approach, but one then wonders at what cost. But as we also think about that, and we think about if we are to move forward and move away from the silo approach, and we're going to be measuring health outcomes, then how are we going to measure those health outcomes that we tend to measure as disease-specific outcomes? And that, for me, was a bit of a challenge. But the other area is NCDs. People say NCDs, and the World Bank put out an NCD paper, even when I was in the World Bank, but mental health wasn't included in the NCDs. And the NCD agenda that is going forward does not include mental health and injuries, although it was mentioned today. So I think this idea of silos, so right now we, as the mental health community, feel, should we now lobby for our own silo mental health, or should we try and tag onto this NCD agenda and make sure mental health is integrated into that? Or should we say health systems and ensure that the health systems actually address the mental health problems? So it's a bit of a, I think, a difficult area.
Florence, could I just pick you up on that in terms of a number of discussions about architecture and structures at national and international level? Do you think within Uganda, what's the best way of getting mental health on the map? Would that be through a more siloed approach, or is there a way of integrating that within deliberations? And is that solution for Uganda necessarily the same one at a global level in terms of ensuring that there is an appropriate voice for the sort of epidemiological concerns regarding mental health burden that we can project?
Well, what we did in Uganda, and I think it was effective. I'll say it was effective. I'll be a little bit American here. what we did in Uganda was to integrate mental health into primary health care, and that began in 1998. And getting mental health there, we were moving away from the silo approach and saying mental health is going to be a part of all the government programs. So as a result of getting mental health in there, we did get almost silo approach to mental health funding. We got an African Development Bank loan, but this loan was not specific for mental health, but it also looked at other primary health care programs. So that was the first 5 years. The second 5 years is looking at mental health, reproductive health, but also strengthening the health system in general. So mental health is in there because we believe it does need a bit of an extra push, having been marginalized for so long, but it's being put in as a part of a broader health program. So in measuring the impact of this program, we have had a first baseline survey for the first project and a second survey for the second one. And we do see that there have been some changes. And I think people do recognize that in Uganda, the access to services for people with mental health problems have improved. And the challenges that we now face are not specific to mental health, but actually challenges that the whole health system is facing. For instance, support supervision, referral, human resources, drug delivery. It's not mental health alone, but the whole health system that has these problems that have to be addressed.
Okay, thank you very much. Prakash, if I can come to you, and again, the same opening question in terms of the discussions of this morning, particularly from your stance and your work, particularly around legal access to natural resources and an obligation to health access, what did you see as the key hooks, the key challenges, the key opportunities in what was being addressed?
In context of Nepal and also in context of global public health issues, as activists, as advocate, we are basically focusing on making those rights as a fundamental rights, as a constitutional right. So because we are in the framing of the constitution, and also wherever its constitution is going on, we are trying to make it as a right-based approach for health as a right, a matter of right. And also we cannot forget about the water and sanitation. That is also a fundamental right. So if we address those issues, then only we can focus on the public health issues, because in our context, in the least developed countries like Nepal, a lot of waterborne diseases are there. So we are focusing on that. And if we want to make an individual, healthy society, healthy nation, and healthy world, I think now we are also focusing on the traditional practices and traditional knowledges should be also acknowledged, and they should be also protected, and investment should be made there, like yogic education as a part of education, and yoga as a system in the education system. So that also reduces a lot of burdens in the investment in the public health sector. So those are major area which we need to be strengthened, and that only we can address the health issue. So landscaping in that context can be shaping the public health.
And Prakash, beginning to move on to an issue that we'll be addressing more thoroughly later on, but in terms of Nepal, the natural allies for you in that work, in terms of the different constituencies represented here, has that been activists working on their own, or who have you found alliances with naturally in terms of promoting that agenda?
Yeah, in that context, I think researchers are, you know, we are working in isolation, that there's a need of integrating all these, you know, actors together. Researchers making research and advocates, you know, working together in collaboration with researchers and bringing those issues. And similarly, at the same time, with the educators, you know, having all these aspects of public health education integrating in these. So three major actors and also the policymakers. Unless we influence it, because there are a lot of policies, say, for example, in reproductive health rights, there are so many discriminatory laws and policies which is impacting on the health of women. So unless we address those issues, unless we change those issues, those discrimination, we are not going to address the things. So I think there is a need in collaboration with the public policymakers, educators, researchers, and activists. So it's a combination of all the actors. So we are trying to work in together.
Thank you, Prakash.
Thank you.
Last but not least, Derek. Again, that opening question, in terms of the range of issues around this morning, in terms of the perspectives that particularly informed from the private sector of traction, of challenge, of opportunity, what came out for you?
Thanks. It's a pretty tough question. I think first I'd say the notion of having to live with constructive ambiguity as a reality, that often our efforts to get the perfect and get everything sorted out distracts us from actually making incremental progress that's going to have big long-term impacts. And I could go into that later, but I think for us that's pretty critical when you're trying to, in our case, change how a company functions and a future vision of the world. The second is the reality that we live in a world of permanent complexity. I got a sense from some of the presentations earlier today that people are hankered back to a nostalgic world when there'd be fewer players out there, there'd be fewer health problems, and can't we just put them back in the box and go back to the ways it used to be? And if you can't do that, let's get them better organized and let's get them nicely, neatly put into boxes so that you can have a more rational and simple way of working together or working within your own silo, as opposed to where I think we are headed, which is a permanent state of increased players asserting themselves in very different ways and competing both for resources, people's times, for relationships, for money, and for issues. And actually growing up to the reality that that is going to be a permanent feature of the future requires us to think in very different ways. Certainly, we need to be far more flexible in how we think about alliances and relationships. We need to make sure that we're very clear about what the goals are of what we're trying to achieve together and have the metrics in place to ensure that we're actually able to achieve those goals. And that would avoid the kind of slippages that can happen. And the last comment that struck me was the relative neglect of prevention. I think if you actually counted up the amount of time spoken about health services and clinical care and health, all the complexity of health services in an audience of leading public health people, I was kind of surprised that it's overweighed, in my mind, heavily towards the treatment of those who are sick, which is very important. But that area, I think, is particularly well covered by our medical, nursing, management sciences, pharmacologists, and others, as opposed to thinking, what is the core that we in public health bring? And to my mind, it always starts, and I look at Linda because we've discussed this before, with being very proud and strong about the core discipline of public health, the distinguishing feature of public health, the thing that I keep telling people why we are different when we go into a company or into a UN agency, is epidemiology. All the other disciplines, all of them, have some analogous or related aspect in other disciplines. Health economics has a strong economics background. The health part is really a second-rate citizen of economics, if we're honest. behavioral sciences come from a strong, proud world of psychology. And so I could go on. But epidemiology is unique, and it brings us a unique power of thinking about causes deeply, and causal chains deeply, and quantifying the impact on large populations and not just on the sick. And that's the discussion that I've failed to hear today. And on the causes, I think Howard drew it home to us very well when he started saying, imagine if you were butterflies in this room. Well, imagine if you were butterflies or bees. We would be discussing very seriously what are our threats to our existence outside of the world of the bee kingdom, and what are the potential alliances that we might have with other insects and with other plants out there to actually strengthen our capability to survive and grow. But that wasn't a discussion we've heard. We focused entirely on human survival as if it's devoid from the rest of the environment. And the one thing I've learned being inside a corporation is that we know that our very survival depends upon the long-term climate change issues. We know that half the crops we're growing today are going to either be underwater or in the middle of a desert 30, 40 years from now. And we better plan accordingly and think about the long-term supply chain and how we're going to secure it if the food supply of the future is going to be secured. And that's a discussion I've yet to hear.
Can I build on that point, Derek, and really come to anyone on the panel? That sense of urgency or non-urgency, that sense that the current structures, the current way of working, business as usual, is not appropriate. We need to rethink that. To what extent do people on the panel feel that this really is a time for thinking differently and for new perspectives, that really there is an urgency in reshaping our alliances, and let's use it metaphorically as the alliances between the six of you, that there's a way of rethinking it to make your lives more productive and more effective in terms of promoting population health. Eamon, I'll come to you first.
I personally think that it's extremely dangerous for us to be accepting of the status quo. You know, one of our speakers this morning talked about anti-secularism. That's not very far from home when, you know, a board of education of one of the states of the United States has banned the writings of Thomas Jefferson as being anti-Christian and replaced them with writings of Thomas Aquinas. So it's not like we are living in a vacuum of not thinking that things that we have gained and successes are permanent. We are always challenged by a variety of forces that are taking us in dimensions that we may not predict. I think public health today is taking a role of leadership in evolving many concepts, one of which is globalization or a global concept. And that is not to be taken for granted. I think personally that public health today has a role in growing new leaders in the future that will take responsibility in many ways, not just in the domain of public health, but also a keenness on understanding from an epidemiological point of view. Thank you for acknowledging the domain, but from a variety of points of view as to the change in variables in their dimension, their complexity, and their interaction, taking away from a biostatistical term. But I think that this is very, very essential, and the world is moving very fast, and the variables are transitioning even faster, politically, socio-demographically, biologically, and ecologically. And I think the thing that is unique about this group of people that are concerned, that are assembled today, is in looking at these perspectives from a global dimension, from all the facets of the crystal, if you'll allow me to use the same metaphor. And that is something that in which we have excelled, I think, over the past decades, and actually some of the successes have themselves been very good fora for us to learn and to learn how to grow.
Miguel, a sense of urgency, and then I'll come to Florence.
I wanted to respond to one of Derek's comments on the, perhaps I misunderstood, on the primacy of epidemiology within public health. Because indeed, well, besides the fact that epidemiology does come from demography and other mathematical sciences, I would argue. But the issue here is that indeed we do need an interdisciplinary approach that to be able to tackle the complexity. When I was mentioning the importance of within health systems research to always keep an eye, a very clear sense of indicators on disease control, is precisely to identify the multiple interactions that we have with the ecosystem and that are determining the incidence of various diseases, as well as with the full range of social and demographic factors that are shaping the environment as a whole. So today we do need more regional approaches in the sense of being able to identify countries that are sharing characteristics in terms of indigenous populations, in terms of the ecosystem, in terms of production structures and politics, so that we're able then to compare health system performance across those countries that are sharing those traits, and that then we can vary the health system design and performance, so we can then have some more robust experimental conditions on which to do that. And there are some opportunities in Africa, in Latin America, where investors are actually coming to realize that they do need that regional multi-country approach that can help us to develop learning networks, structures, and to have common implementation pathways, but within which we can then learn on the influence of context.
Florence, then I'll come back to Derek.
Thank you. I was also just going to comment about the interdisciplinarity of the new way of working. But moving on from that is also relating to responsibilities and mandates. And I think when we are thinking about global public health, and I think we have to separate this from global health, we think of global health. But that tends, for me, global health relates to things like AIDS, TB and malaria, and treating disorders at a global level, making sure they don't cross borders to get into here or something. But then the global public health for me is as was mentioned by, I forget his name, but from CDC. I think more the preventive side of things, yeah, and more the surveillance and regulation at a global level. But if we are thinking about responsibilities, who has the responsibility at the individual level, because the individuals eventually become the global population, at the national and at the global. In Uganda right now, we're other than the homophobia that you all heard about, we are right now tackling a Jigger epidemic in one part of the country. And it's a huge shame because for me, I think I hope you all know what Jiggers are. They're things that tend, little fleas that infect the toes and the feet, but now they are moving up and people have died of Jiggers apparently. So they say it's due to hygiene, but we've got a whole district that's actually been affected by Jiggers, and they've had to bring in a whole national task force on Jigger elimination. And some people are asking, and I'm one of those, where does the individual responsibility for personal hygiene come in, and where does the state responsibility come in? And I hope that global won't have to come in to prevent Jiggers in Uganda, you know? So I think it's also about responsibilities and also about the mandate. Who has the mandate? And are we going to need to put together a new initiative that will then have the mandate? Because we heard about how uncoordinated and disaggregated, very many different units all doing their own thing. So do we need a new one, or do we build on the already existing bodies that we have and then give them the mandate for global public health?
Yeah. I wanted to use that as a bridge to your middle point, I think, Derek, which I understood as the alliances we have will be complex. And there's an assumption that's quite important for the latter part of our day together, as we may have different mandates and different missions and different capacities, but is there a vision that can unite us. And what you were saying, I read as ambiguously, either we actually acknowledge we're trying to do different things and we might manage to find political alliances in the short term that are useful even though we're going in different directions, or you may mean, or it may be, that there actually is an overall vision for public health leadership that we could construct, we could understand, acknowledging that we have different parts to play in that. So could you elaborate a little bit on that idea of the complexity and the transient nature of our alliances?
I think a worthwhile, very detailed discussion would be on whether we ever could or should heal the schism between health systems and services on the one hand and prevention and many of the other broader intersectoral aspects of public health on the other. Because it strikes me that they are two very different groups of people with different personalities. It's not a private-public divide issue. It's a question of some, from an ethical point of view, feel that their reason for existence is to deal with the sick who are in front of them today. And that's a very worthwhile, very noble, critical point of view. There are others who have a greater sense of delayed gratification in trying to shift the trends that we see emerging to stop those getting sick. And it's such a basic underlying philosophical approach. I think when we try and do the two together, both sides fail. I think that the alliances that are being created, I don't know about the health systems alliances, but I certainly know the ones that are being created around, for example, the nexus of agriculture, nutrition, health, and the environment, are terribly exciting and do offer a lot of hope. And they're not private or public determined. Some happen to be public institutions, some are private. But they're sharing this common concern around resource scarcity looming in the future as the biggest concern to worry about. In the same way as many of us were drawn into public health in the first place when you saw what was going to be almost the inevitable rising curve of tobacco deaths, or the first time we saw HIV seroprevalence rates at 0.2% on the Zimbabwean border and knew that inevitably, unless we acted, they were going to take off. The question I think that we all have to face is when you see these epidemiological curves early on in their development, how can we accelerate the sense of urgency to act before they totally overwhelm us and we're having to deal with the treatment consequences as opposed to the prevention potential?
But Bernice, can I come to you on one aspect of Derek's suggestion, which is the pragmatic separation or understanding of the different tribes or different sensitivities in terms of health systems and delivery and in terms of prevention, in terms of, I guess, intersectoral linkages and broader structural determinants. Sitting within the Ministry of Health in Liberia, does that sense of division of labour and responsibility make sense to you, or how do you see your responsibilities within the government of Liberia, both to provide a coherent health system or to support that development, but also to acknowledge that there are many other factors leading to disease that are the responsibilities and mandates of other ministries?
Well, from the Ministry of Health, we know that all the health needs cannot be addressed by the Ministry of Health alone. And from Liberia's standpoint, we tend to form task forces that also that includes other partners, other stakeholders from other sectors. And we work together on addressing issues that are health-related but have other people's input in it from other sectors. Now, we also extend that to also partners. This morning, one of the presenters talked about fragmentation in global health governance and how it's been difficult to, even at the global level, looking at health systems, to actually, those who support health systems, to work together, align their resources behind one goal. And that tends to actually affect how we work at the local level, also in coordinating the resources that do come in to support the health system. And often, from those who look at it from a global perspective, especially at a country level, they expect governments to drive the agenda. And they expect government to coordinate the issues on the ground. But sometimes it is difficult to actually coordinate because the agenda, because globally, the agenda is also defined globally. And so bringing it to coordinating it properly at the local level also tend to pose some challenges at the local level.
Okay, thank you, Bernice. Before we throw it open to some general questions, I just want to do one quick run along the line. I'll perhaps start at the other end and bring it this way. We've begun to articulate the sense of a vision of working together and trying to create structures to do that. There's a sense of a continuity with what's gone in the past, but also new particular circumstances that mean rethinking. We'll talk in groups later in the afternoon about trying to flesh out that vision and how pragmatic and how coordinated and how institutional it is. I just more like a straw poll on the second part of the activity that people will be doing, which is the key agendas within to fulfill that sort of vision, that some key practical steps or some key programmatic areas where you see that within the next 3 to 5 years, say, we really need, if this is a new emerging set of circumstances, requires a rethinking of governance, a reformulation, then some areas where there's real traction, real need, real opportunity for difference. Derek.
To just keep on the prevention theme, I would say that if public health could forge stronger partnerships with those in agriculture, environment, and urban design, those three specific areas, I think we'd be able to achieve dramatic improvements in global health over the medium term.
Gosh, can I come to you? And a key actionable agenda within the next 3 to 5 years that would begin to solidify some of the things we've been talking about at a visionary level.
I do agree with Derek what he said. I think holistic approach, integrating with this, all these areas, ecological aspects also be looked at, and collaborative efforts from all the stakeholders will be the major focus for these 3 to 5 years that will be addressing the public health issues.
Could I pick, given the word sort of rights and ethics were addressed this morning, what things need to be done, do you see, to secure that clear rights foundation? Or do you feel it is well secured, or are there things that need to be done by not just yourselves within legal NGOs, but across the board to protect that vision? Maybe that is one of the elements that would bring us together, a sense to which there is that global solidarity in terms of some fundamental rights that we're seeking to assert. Is that safe, or do you think there needs to be consolidated action to protect that?
I think that there is a need to recognition of these basic rights as a fundamental rights, and recently General Assembly has addressed that water and sanitation is a basic right. So I think we need to consolidate those rights and ensure that those rights are there, because there are efforts going on to take those rights. So I think strengthening those rights is very important.
Okay, thank you. Florence, key things on the agenda for you.
For me, something actionable would be to sort of begin, like Bernice was saying, to come up with a strategy. But this strategy shouldn't start at the global level, but maybe begin at the national level, and maybe facilitate a process of bringing together. So first of all, map who the actors are, differentiating them in researchers, policymakers, and implementers, and then their different roles there, because even within researchers, you have public, you have private for profit, private not for profit, and so differentiate all these different levels. And policymakers, you may have those in the Ministry of Health, those in social protection, education, all these other areas that we talked about, and then the implementers as well, cutting across the different sectors, and then have them together at country level map what they think the global public health strategy should be, and then bring this together maybe at a national level, and that's my dream. I mean at a global level, and then you come up with your global public health strategy.
Thank you. Thanks. From the research perspective, what I would emphasize in the coming years is to develop tools and methods that can effectively bridge the debates and the constituencies, which I agree here with Derek, definitely, that there are very different constituencies in public health, in health systems, in clinical medicine, that need to come together to be able to share the vision and to apply it. And indeed, bringing qualitative and quantitative methods, very much as you did earlier today with concept mapping of broad regions of problems, that can enable us to look at health systems through a more realist perspective. In other words, health systems are tools to make strategies, to make alliances. We need to define health systems for specific problems rather than the other way around. And to that effect, to try to extend the boundary of health systems defined as those activities and actors that have primary functions for health, to relate them to the other actors that may not see themselves as health workers, but that have extremely important impacts on health, and vice versa, to cross that bridge. How can health help on the education agenda, and vice versa, for example? So then we define the health system or the social system eventually that can help us in specific contexts and for specific problems realize the vision of global health.
Yeah, just to build on that, and I couldn't agree with you more, is really translating that into our educational agenda. There are several aspects of this. First is, as much as we need to define the uniqueness of different communities and cultures and health scenarios, we also need to define the commonalities. It's very important. Second is emphasizing interprofessional education as a very important domain of training of public health professionals, emphasizing the interdisciplinarity of our profession and our mandate. The third is to emphasize leadership as an important skill and a competency to be very well defined in global health education, and back that up with very strong skills in coalition building. And these are very well-defined competencies now that we need to infuse into our educational programs, both in the Northern and Southern Hemisphere, in order for us to be able to work together and even work together better than we have in the past.
Denise, key agenda.
Well, I will take human resources out of the health systems and look at human resources, because we need the human resources to deliver the healthcare for the global good. And this morning we heard that one statement that we are stuck in the paradigm of the past. We use the same, when we think about health, we think about nurses, doctors, physician assistants. But from the discussions here today, we realize that there are a lot of players who are not health professionals within, who also help to shape the health agenda. And I believe that if we can package some of the trainings and deliver them to the right people, we might be able to make some headways.
Okay, thank you, Bernice. We have opportunity is for people to raise their hand and to grab a microphone. So I saw Joseph first. If you just go around the side of the table, Joseph, also ask someone to pass it to you. And I'd encourage you to either put a question to an individual on the panel or more generally. It gives us an opportunity to further break open this discussion. Thank you, Joseph.
I just wanted to ask the question that I saw that in our discussion today, the question of power imbalance or not mentioned. Because we have talked about inequities, but I don't know how we can manage talk about global health without talking about change of power at global level, movement from bipolar world to multipolar world, where you have got emerging countries coming in. What impact those emerging powers will have on global health? Because I think the West is still living in the past, thinking that, but I think things are changing, and they will have impact on how we see the future world and the global health patterns. That's the first question which I wanted to ask about. What will be the impact of the emerging powers movement from bipolar world where we had Soviet Union and U.S. Now we have China, Brazil, I mean BRICS coming in and all that.
Joseph, can I just limit you to one just for now? I promise you a second, some later on if we have the chance, just so we can go around. So I want to go around two or three questions, and then we'll put them around the panel. John, right at the back, if you can grab the microphone that's nearest to you, I think just to the left of you. Thanks, Joseph.
Thanks. Yeah, John Beard from the World Health Organization. First of all, I'd just like to endorse the comments on a focus on prevention and intersectoral action, and also the idea of training and capacity building. I think we do need to be thinking along those lines. But I have a question, and it is, we've heard how diverse a set of players there are now in the field, but in the past it really used to be dominated by WHO. I'm wondering, what is the role for WHO in that broader set of players?
Thank you, John. Can I take one or two more questions? Yeah, there's a question there in the middle. And then I'll come to Hussein at the front.
this is Amini Massoud from Egypt. I just have a comment rather than a question on human rights. A lot of the speakers mentioned the right to health as an important component of global health, but I just think we cannot stress enough the importance of it, not as an ideology, but more as a legal instrument and tool that countries have signed to, because it places an obligation not only on countries to fulfill the right to health of their own citizens, but also on countries of the North with more resources to give assistance to these countries. So I think the right to health should be emphasized with reference to the legal instruments and tools that are out there in support of any action on global health. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. So I'll come to Hussein here at the front, and then Rohit here. Oh. I think it's on. It should be on.
Okay, I've been troubled by a much more generic question. And the generic question is that in terms of the broad scope of this discussion, which is the changing landscape of global health, and I understand that, and it's been amply demonstrated about the demographic changes and all of that, but somehow I can't see how the things that we've discussed, which seems to require a lot of activity, innovation, discovery, new ways of thinking, new ways of acting, new ways of implementation, were the problems I have seen. And I can, you know, I'm pretty sure it's similar in Africa and probably in India. China may be a bit different, but my problem is that the problems I see don't require so much of innovation. They don't require so many discoveries. We need all, and I'm not being a Luddite. I don't mean that we need no discoveries of new way of delivering health services, whether we should explore mid-level, you know, that stuff I accept. But it doesn't require the extent and scale and grandeur of all these discoveries, because the things that we already know and have known for donkey's years are not being implemented. It's nurses and doctors who are not doing the work efficiently. It's clinics which close beforehand. It's sanitation which isn't there. The point is that you really don't need that. So maybe there's so much of diversity in the world in terms of the problems that we will have to rethink the scale of innovation that is needed. And that's complicated now by all these external actors, and it's the impossibility of getting them to coordinate the activities.
Thank you so much. So a final question from Rohit to the front, and then we'll go down the line.
Yeah, I was actually going to echo some of the comments that Hussein made. I'm from Chapel Hill, by the way. I'm trained as an engineer, and so in my mind, I like to think of things in concrete ways. And so I've been listening to the words here like strategy and agenda, and these are great things, great and important things. I think multidisciplinarity is important. But the question is really, what is it that we're actually going to do in a very practical way? And so I would like to throw another word into the mix for the consideration of the panel, and that is prototype. Because the way that I work or I think about working with complex issues is to be able to deconstruct them and build prototypes that we can test. And I'd like to kind of test with this panel what the thought is on using that word and that terminology as a way of moving ahead with over the next couple of days.
Okay, thank you. I think you volunteered to go first, Derek, so you probably have a choice on perhaps pick a couple of those and then we'll go along the line, see what coverage we have.
Let me take two. First, the question of power, because I think we've got two people here who I've read their work and respected enormously over decades, who have spoken about this from different perspectives. Julia has taught us about the power of ideas and never to underestimate the way that the world gets shaped by ideas. And that's the core reason for academia. And so that's a special plea to never underestimate the power, and particularly of framing and reframing and constantly reframing the debate. I think Howard saying to us, let's frame the debate from the point of view of a bee or a butterfly. How would this debate change profoundly if we were to think from that as a starting point, just as one example? The second, which Gita has brought us, is the power of civil society. She made a direct attack on the industry sector I work for in her presentation. And I say that, and I know her well enough to be able to say it here, that the civil society case and the civil society advocacy can never be underestimated as having disproportionately more power than they understand. And I say that because often you have folks out there saying, well, you know, we are advocating for this, and you have human rights groups, and you have health groups, and you have... Well, it was those groups that changed pharmaceutical pricing. It was those groups that brought us the Tobacco Convention. It was those groups that have brought us so much in public health that we have. And it's those groups that are helping to shape the future of the food and the agricultural sector. Often, the power, though, is misinterpreted as being in the hands of those who have the money and the financial resources. I think that's a misreading of where the true power for change comes from. And if you combine the right ideas with civil society, you can change the world.
Derek, can I actually move you on to Prakash? Yeah. I'm sorry, I think we'll just have to have one response.
Can I make one comment about WHO?
Yes.
Because obviously it's a great question, and I hope all of you address it. I would just, if I had to say two things that I think they need to be doing more of, clearly the issues of norms and standards that Julia said, the seemingly boring stuff, and secondly, metrics and surveillance and putting good advocacy behind them, and cut out a lot of the operational stuff.
So Prakash, any of those questions that came up you want to tackle
particularly? Yeah, just the right to health as a, you know, a legal instrument, how that helps. I think at the national level, a national constitution, and also in the national international conventions or conventions. For example, like we have not signed, we have signed the FCTCC, and as mentioned by Derek, that with that instrument, we are able to ban smoking in the public places. So if you have a legal instrument that allows civil society to go forwards and advocate for that and establish that right, banning advertisement in the print media and other media, that also done through that. So if we have a health right as a fundamental right in the constitution, and also somewhere in the international instrument that allows advocacy group to bring those rights in the reality.
Thank you, Rohit.
Thank you. In relation to the issue on power, I think I'd like to differ from Derek and say that coming from a low-income country, we recognize very clearly that it is the person who has the money and who pays the piper who then calls the tune. And very often, as Minister Banis said, very often when people come in with money for HIV/AIDS, even if you want to do something else, you can't. Very often, you can't. And so maybe what we need to do is to empower low-income country governments to understand that they do have the power to say no to money. But if you're starving in your house and somebody offers you a banana and you'd rather have meat, you're going to eat the banana, because very often the aid that comes in as a real living example is food that is not even eaten in some parts of the world, but it's dropped there as aid, and then they learn how to eat it because that's what they have. So that's the reality, and that's what power does. Power sometimes goes with the resources, and that's the reality. But we need to think about then the power at the global level and then the power at the national level, and we've had quite a bit about how even national governments have become disempowered because of the resources that come in and that are now being more and more driven by the public, by the private sector. In relation to the role of WHO, I just wanted to add that maybe if we are to not begin a whole new initiative, this could be one area where the global public health function could be built on, strengthen the mandate of WHO, since we seem to think that it has lost some of the power that it had. It needs to be maybe given some of that power back.
Florence, could I ask you to pass it on to Miguel?
Just one more prototype. Teeny. On the prototype, very short. I think we can't build a prototype like there's a magic bullet, but we can teach public health specialists how to address problems within their own countries, because the context is always going to be different. So
thanks,
it's
Florence.
Teaching them how to, rather than one thing you need to do that will work in all countries.
Miguel.
I agree that WHO has to step up to the plate to become the global steward, and that precisely is a function that many have identified for WHO today and for the near future. I think that in the health systems literature, there are a number of proposals to identify reforms and specific features of health system financing, health system advocacy, governance, and so forth, that can be identified in terms of their performance characteristics. And I'm addressing here the plight for an engineering framework that I think it's available. It's a question of systematizing and enabling comparative assessments of those features and those characteristics of reforms in their relationship to disease control and performance. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Amen.
Thank you. A quick response to power is, I always teach my students and I always remind myself that advocacy can never replace representation. You represent yourself, and hence you empower yourself. And power is going to be in numbers. And the more those that are burdened with the largest burden of health challenges represent themselves in fora of global health, the more they're going to be heard and the more they're going to make a change. That's very, very important. It's very essential for me to keep harping on the issue of preparing a new class of public health workforce in the countries that are burdened with the largest disease burden. On the other hand, going back to the basics, thank you, Hossein, yes, indeed, some of the problems have simple solutions that we have forgotten how to use. We cannot make global health and public health a journalistic science. We are in the kitchen, peeling the potatoes and chopping the onions. That's why we're in global health. And I really think that we need to remind ourselves that the kinds of competencies we give our students need to be journalistic sometimes, but mainly kitchen competencies. They need to know how to make that omelette, not just write a menu. Thank you.
Then it's the final word.
Well, I will support my colleagues on re-engineering WHO to provide a leadership for global health. We started to see fragmentation when we started to see increased support to global health. And that alone poses challenges for countries. And we think if we should reorganize and support, if we should change one thing from here, is to support and put WHO in the position where it should be to provide a leadership for global health. Thank you.
Thank you, Bernice. And before we formally thank the panel, I just want to explain that the transition to the next part of the program, we are at a break, in which we'll be able to take drinks at the back. When we come back, you need to go to almost certainly a new table. We're entering a period of group work when, in a sense, as small groups, we'll be addressing something of the challenges that we were throwing to our participants here, both to formulate whatever vision it might be that would bind us together in terms of common action, but also some of the key steps for it. And just very much to build on Jerry's last point that was commented on, there is the sense to which this agenda is, to use Christina's phrase, progressive. There may be aspects of that agenda that are 40 years prescient in terms of thinking what's coming, but there may be other aspects that are acute issues now, and we very much encourage the agenda and the vision to reflect both of those. So, in one moment, a warm applause for the panel. Enjoy your tea, and please come back to the table, which should be indicated on the reverse of your badge. If you take your badge off and don't drop the magnet, you should find the colour group that you're in. And this is a constituency group that we are not locking you in a silo for the rest of the meeting. We're just, as the way we did here, encouraging people that are currently working broadly in similar sectors to reflect on these issues when tomorrow we will come very much in multidisciplinary, multi-sectoral, multi-constituency groups to seek to address them. So applause to the panel, please.